Today on the podcast, we have a very special guest, the author of Convicts, The Rising of a Miami Sun, participant of a 21-day hunger strike with the Hunger 9, and foundational member of the Circle of Brotherhood, my friend, Albert Sonny Campbell. What'd you think?
It's just what I needed.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Brings you to center, right?
Yes, sir.
Man. So what'd you see?
Well, I saw just what they said. My mom, she transitioned a few months ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
So I seen her, felt her presence, and my grandparents, my daughter, all my ancestors whom I know, presence of those who I don't know, just felt the sense of the direction that the meditation led me to. I freely traveled there, and I'm in a better place.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. That's the whole point. That's, so the meditation that we did just a second ago, it's not going to be on the podcast, but I usually do a meditation to connect with our lineage, right? Because so much of our intuition is lost by disconnection in that lineage, right? And the meditation, the idea of the meditation is that you connect, even if you didn't know your parents or had a difficult relationship with them or whatever that is, the position to be in is just, if, you know, maybe there was, you know, trauma or whatever that looks like. But if you can start from a place of just being grateful for bringing you into this world, that's it, right?
Yes, yes.
Everything else is between them and God,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, yes.
So if you're able to get to that place, you can connect with at least the thread of origin, you know? And that goes all the way to God, right? It's like if you connect to the original ancestor and the original source of life, and through all of us, we're all connected, right? So I really like starting with that because it opens space and sets us in the right mindset to have this conversation, you know?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me how I know you were the courageous one. That's how I see it. You know, we connected on Facebook, right? Kind of out of the blue. This guy kind of messages you out of nowhere. This guy from Facebook is like, "Hey man, you guys are doing something pretty cool. It's very courageous and powerful what you guys are doing. You were part of the Hungry Nine. That was really incredible. I know you've had a lot of experience in life, many facets. And just having the courage to be like, "Hey man, let's talk to this guy. I don't know this person from Adam," and come down and you guys welcome me with open arms to the organization. I know you're one of the founding members, right, of the Circle of Brotherhood, or one of the core members of the Circle of Brotherhood. I know you host a lot of the meetings. So tell me a little bit about how you came into this world.
Well, I came into this world into my beautiful family. When I think about it, at first it seemed like I came into a struggle. But as I get older, you know, having some knowledge of our ancestors and the spirits and how they go and come back again, it brings me back to how you started the meditation off, being grateful, having gratitude. So my childhood life was really, I wouldn't say it was as bad as some, but not as worse as others. What makes it unique is, like, I've met you as a friend, and to have an opportunity to come and experience some things that I knew, especially that meeting that we had. What's the sister name that came with you?
Sophie Sudai.
Sophie.
Yeah.
And it's very ironic, and I had said this to you yesterday, that when you were departing, it felt like we just had got finished with that meeting that we had, that you and Sophie came and blessed the Circle of Brotherhood. And I felt it in my spirit. And so you talk about how we met. And so I understand that we met a long, long time ago. So Facebook was like a conduit ready to connect us back.
A reacquaintance.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, it's just awesome. So, I mean, I could talk about my childhood, you know, growing up in project-like settings, mother on drugs, stepfather on drugs, selling drugs, using drugs. And I kind of thought when I was young that I loved my mom so much. And I'm 58 years old now. So when I was young, you could not look in grown people's mouth. When grown people had conversations that only grown people were supposed to hear, you already knew not to stick around, not to listen around, like you being nosy.
Mm.
So I understood that. And so I had to kind of watch my mom and everything she did without her knowing, without her being aware of it. And so I oftentimes hear stories about men saying that they started using drugs when they were 9 years old and 8 years old. And I would hear that sometime and didn't give it much thought. But over the past year, I started thinking about that. Because the way I lived, my brother and I could actually see myself probably being a junkie at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. That could have happened. And so I remember when I'm a published author, I have two books. And I remember when my mom read my raw manuscript. I wrote that manuscript when I was in prison serving a 35-year federal prison sentence. And so I had sent to the raw pages of the manuscript. And so one day I called her, you know, like I usually do, and she picked up the phone, and she, as soon as I heard her picked up the phone, she began to weep, like, uncontrollably. And I was asking, Mom, what's wrong? What's wrong? And she said, I've read your manuscript. And she said, I want to apologize to you because you didn't have a chance to live your own life.
Mm.
And so I live with that, you know. And it was bad. I remember bringing my report card home from school one day, and I had all Fs, F3Fs all the way down. And while my mom, she was using drugs and selling drugs, she still loved me. And still loved us, and she still laid the law down and laid the rules down. And so when I came home with that bad report card and gave it to her, she beat me, like, really bad. And I deserved it, right? And so I say, well, when I did go to school, it was kind of like almost like a vacation.
Mm.
To get away from what had become normal in my life. So I was in school, but I wasn't interested in school. You know, so when I wasn't around my mom and in school, I was worrying about what was happening to her. Was she going to overdose? Or was my stepfather was going to beat her to death? So I wasn't concentrating on school, period. And so when she chastised me that time, I said, well, I'll just go ahead and make good grades, but I'll still worry about her. while I'm in school, you know, not knowing what to expect when I got back home, me and my brother walking home, not knowing what to expect. You know, and I think about all of those things, and then I think about the power of our ancestors and who we are. And maybe when I came here before, maybe I was on the opposite side of the way I lived my life. So maybe I came back to get that experience and have the opportunity to be on your podcast and to meet you and to share the story, because a lot of people go through different things, but it's just as horrific, you know?
Yeah. And it's a testament to the human spirit to be on this side of it whole.
Correct.
You know, it's the resilience of the human spirit to be on this side. That's a very encouraging message.
Yes.
You know, of what the human being can endure and still come out and have. I mean, because I've listened to you on Facebook, and I've listened to how you speak and how you come from a place of gratitude and humility. And, you know, the dedication that you've done to the cause of, you know, the brotherhood. And it speaks to somebody that has seen the spectrum of life, right, of suffering and joy, and has had a complete human experience, you know?
Yeah.
So tell me, what was the process like of writing and kind of releasing that, like, it, because it seems like it was very cathartic process for you to kind of put that stuff on paper. And how did you get there?
Well, a few people was mentioning to me to write a book, and I didn't really know how to write a book, so I started off writing events the way I remember them. And one of my friends that was in prison with me, he was a writer. And so he put all those events very artfully and skillfully into book form. But I had to relive all those things over again, right? And that was one of the reasons why my mom was apologizing, because she told me, she said, "How do you remember all of this stuff?" She said, "Some of this stuff I never confronted. I never dealt with it properly, and I never healed from. But how did you remember all of that stuff?" And it was a lot. So I was able to write those events down and live through them as I wrote them down. Feeling each event as it came and as I knew it. Wasn't quite able to really fully describe it, but I was able to write down events up to the point where I was in prison and at present. And so I would have to say, even now, that was a healing in itself, even if I didn't know it while I was writing it. And even if I'm just, there's some things that I'm coming aware of, just, you know, just sitting with you right now. Like I said, the meditation set everything up. So a lot of good things, a lot of good vibrations is going on right now. And I'm just, you know, when I look back on what I appear or what I thought was suffering, and I look on it now, and I'm like, you know, it's amazing, because I always would like to give parents a message, because every parent will have to, like, search deep down in themselves one day if they find a child in a hard situation. And then they'll ask themselves, could I have done right? Could I have done anything differently? Could I have been a better parent? And so, when my mom told me, she said it was her fault, I'm like, nah, mom, it's... society reared you, and you reared us. You know, to take some of that sting off of her And so that's one of my messages that I have in the podcast that I'm starting, is to not have to have a parent to feel the guilt that my mom felt, because she's not perfect. You know, if she could have written it perfect, it would have been perfect. But she told me, she moved in Georgia. She said every day for 5 years, she used to walk the streets for 5 or 6 miles every day, whether it was raining or cold or hot, and ask God, say, God, why did you take both of my sons? And so it's a wonder that she didn't just tilt over the edge in her own mental capacity. And so my thing, like, some things you can't control, but it's present and it's real, you know. I mean, one time myself, I had one of my daughters passed from sickle cell anemia. And when I finally found out what sickle cell anemia is, it's a blood disease. And so I started going to war and having issues with my own blood. Because I thought, like, if I would have had better blood, then my daughter would be alive. Right? And then I had to come to grips. I had to make atonement with my own blood, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm just grateful for life every day. You know, after spending 22.3 years in federal prison, knowing well that the things that so-called free people have, it could be taken away in the blink of an eye, you know. So you probably couldn't fathom right now somebody taking your children, come here, and taking your wife, and taking things that we just have for a long period of time. And so I have a perspective about life that many have and many don't have, and I'm just grateful for every second that I'm allowed to breathe on this side of the prison, from out of prison. I'm grateful, man.
That's big.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would imagine that there's so many people that come out of that situation that are resentful, right? How did you go through that process of making peace with that dynamic in general? What was that process like?
So I think I've always had the feeling, in the presence of my ancestors and our ancestors with me, and I had always had a measure of intellect. And I know, had I been in any other environment, I could have been the best in any environment that I was placed in. And so I just made the best of what I seen and what I had by my choice, because there's other little boys and little girls grow up in the same place, or even worse than me, and they thrive in that community just like I would have thrived in any other community. And then I always knew that what I wasn't doing wasn't right, but I never physically hurt nobody. And I was in the thick of everything, but I always wanted people to be safe, even though I was doing wrong. And so I think when I was 18 years old, so when I finished school, I remember my mom, I had a Burger King job. We were living in the projects. I had a Burger King job at Burger King, my first job. And I had caught the flu or the pneumonia or something, right? And so I must have lost like 15 pounds, you know. And so my mom took me to Burger King, you know, to show the manager that, hey, he's really sick and he'll come back to work when he heal up. when he gets better, right? So the guy fired me from the job, and I lived around in the projects where people sold drugs all day, every day. And so I tried it, right? And what happened, it all came back to me. It kicked in. Say, hey, man, you could have really been good at this when you was 9, 10, 11 years old. You know how to do this. And so I had like the intellect of like what you would call like a scholar around people that were supposed to be teachers. So I was really young, but I was really smart, smarter than all the rest of the guys. But the way that I was raised when I was 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, after I lost that job, those skills kicked in on me. And I started working in the area that I lived with, that I knew about, like it was my brother, like it was in my, like I, it was no, a no-brainer, you know. And so I understood that when I was in prison. And I had a dream shortly after that when I was 18 years old. And the dream said, you think you're smart. He say, all the people your age, they go to jail, but you, some kind of way you figure it out and you don't go. Say, but you're going to get caught one day. And when you get caught, you're going to get a lot of time, but you're not going to do it all. And so the dream showed me what appeared to be a jail cell, the shape of the window, the colors of the desks and the garbage cans that was in the room. It showed me a color portrait of that room, right? And then I shared it with my brother that was a couple of years younger than me at that time. So when the federal government got me and him, we started off in Atlanta, USP Atlanta Penitentiary. And so when we got in the cell, me and him were cellmates. When I got in the cell, I looked around in the cell. And I told my brother, I say, Marvin, do you remember that dream that I told you that I had when I was 18 years old? And at that time, I was 30 years old. He said, yeah. I said, you remember it? He said, yeah. I say, explain to me what you remember about the dream that I told you about. And so he told me the size, the shape of the window. And I looked at the window when he said it. Then I looked at the desk and the color of the desk. And he described everything in that dream. And I said, look around. I said, this is the cell. Mm. So I held on to that. To the dream that I had, the dream said that you would get a lot of time, but you won't do it all. And it was that voice that kept pulling at me and pulling at me when I wanted to just migrate into the prison scene. And you know, it's more things happening in there, and you wouldn't believe what goes on in prison. You could buy drugs, you could sell drugs, you could do all that stuff in prison. And so it was that voice that kept telling me, you gonna get out. And so when I would get ready to do something that I wasn't supposed to be doing, it was this older guy named Mr. Reagan. And it looked like he would be standing right there and he'd be like, come here. Y'all come here. And he'll call me and my brother. He'd say, stop it. Y'all gonna get out. I don't care how it look. Y'all gonna get out. I was in y'all position before. So it was that voice and then the voice of Mr. Reagan that kept pulling me to the right when everything told me to go to the left. And I think that helped carry me through. And then I searched God. I searched for God.
Yeah, that's, you know, one of the things that I'm really interested in is that systemic momentum that we were talking about. It's like if you're in the current, it's hard to get out. You know, mm-hmm. And then if somebody gets out, they get pulled back in by the momentum. You know, it's easy to fall back into that momentum.
It all depends on, like we talked about, the force.
Yeah.
You know, whatever force is stronger, because it's a force in me, and I promise you, man, I never think about wrong things. You know, sometimes people think about it again. Oh, but those thoughts, they don't come to mind. Whenever I mention them, it'd be for a teaching moment and for a reason. But the thought never come to my mind, because I always keep my momentum stronger than the momentum that want to say, no, they going to pull you back. You're going to go back. Everybody go back and try to put me in a box. But, I mean, you have to go through a certain depth of suffering. And the deeper you suffer, the more you figure out you don't like to suffer in that kind of way.
Yeah, it's the story of Christ. You know, it's the worst that could ever happen. It really is the worst that could ever happen to somebody. Yeah. It's the worst story. You were betrayed. Everybody knows you're innocent. There's a doctor that talks about it. Jordan Peterson talks about this. Like, if you listen to the story of Christ, it's the worst thing that could happen to somebody. Their best friend betrays them. They know they're going to be executed in the worst possible way. You know, he knows he's going to be executed in the worst possible way. Everybody knows that they're innocent. The authority knows that he's innocent and washes his hands of it, and then goes to hell. And then cries out to God for nothing, for, you know, says, why have you forsaken me? Well, what have I done? Like that story of like the depth of despair and shedding the old you and being born anew is the hero's journey.
And you know what, John, like I knew that I had did wrong. But there will always be people come to me, and I know it was the ancestors. And it was a guy, he was a preacher, but he was a CO, a correction officer. And he called me one day, he said, You don't supposed to be here. And the way he said it, it came from somewhere, from a place. Mm-hmm. You know, so I always had those voices, you know, always had those voices to come in, and I guess they was, you call it momentum, they was pushing me to where I needed to go. So I don't have regrets about where I've been, only because where I'm at now, it was all worth it. So, man, if I would have went in there and done 2 or 3 years, I wouldn't have had enough momentum behind me.
Mm.
To overcome the force that was coming towards me. So I needed 22 years and 3 months. I needed every day of that, you know, in order to be a instrument for our people that's not here to speak it with vocal cords,
yeah.
Meaning our ancestors. So I'm just so grateful, man.
It's such a powerful position to be in. It really is a position of power to say, thank you for that experience, because it integrated into me and who I am now. Because if you reject it, you know, it's like it's you don't integrate it, right? If you reject it, it's almost like you might be tempted to fall into the same dynamic again, or like whatever that looks like, right? It's like, but if you're grateful to it, you integrate the shadow as much as the light, and it's just, you integrate the whole being, and you can step into, you know, the future self, right? Is that, is the power of full integration. You know, it's like the suffering as much as the joy, the loss as much as the win, the, you know, the trauma, all of it, is you take all of those things in, and that slight change of perspective. And that's the thing that I noticed the most when I talked to you, is like, you have a perspective that's so powerful. That's strong, that has a place of gratitude. And I know that's not somewhere that you just get out of a fortune cookie, you know.
I've been fortunate enough, and I always think about it. I think the last thing that I did is I spoke at the March for Our Lives rally that they had in Parkland. And through my constant momentum to do right and be right and to share, man, I've done some amazing things. And people, they would talk to me about it, and they wonder, I'd be looking at them, and sometimes I say, are you talking to me? Mm. Did I do that? Was I able to do what you telling me that I did? And I'd be looking like, I'd be like a blank look in my face. You know, because, you know, where I came from to the things that, because I chose to do right, the positions, if my mindset wasn't like it is, I would have never met you.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be no reason for me and you to ever have a conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I think it's so courageous. Like, it's so courageous to be open.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's where real courage comes from.
Yeah.
It's not courage is like, I'm going to put a mean face. I'm going to, you know, like body up or whatever that looks like. It's like, no, man, just being open and being vulnerable and being like, yeah, man, I'll talk to you. I don't know you, but I'll talk to you. Like, coming down and you get just and it's not only from you, it was like from everybody in that group. It's the culture of the group is like that. It's like, dude, come on down, man. We'll do. And when Sophie came down, we were like, welcome with open arms into this organization. It was just so powerful. And that's where magic happens. You know, like the workshop that we did was powerful because you guys are good custodians of that space. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I would equally have to say the same thing about you.
I appreciate that.
You know, because, just anybody can't come into any space just because the space is there. You would know. You know, I'm a feely type guy. So when I walk to a place, I could feel something. No, let's don't go to that gas station. Mm. Let's go to the next gas station. I don't know what would have happened, but I've known that my intuition that I have tells me to follow that what I hear, you know. Yeah. And when I seen you on Facebook, and it's not like, I mean, we didn't start hugging each other then, but we knew at a point that we was going to talk. And I'm like, no, man. I mean, John, when I seen you, I have to, it's John. Oh, hey. You know, yeah. Because it's just such a natural thing.
Yeah.
So it's equal parts.
Yeah.
You know, so
I think there's a resonance that happens with intuition. And that's, you know, the thing that I've been trying, because I wasn't always like this. You know what I mean? Like, I've been through some shit, you know, and wrapped up in my own world. Right. And it wasn't until I started doing that deep dive, you know, like looking at my own demons and, you know, not making friends with my demons, like loving my demons, you know, like becoming very acquainted with my demons and integrating those demons into who I am. It wasn't until I was able to do that, that I was able to really connect with my intuition, because I was just so up in, you know, my own, I was just not in my place. You know, I was like, I was, you know, trying to parent my parents and, you know, be something to other people that I wasn't. And when the wrong relationship, the whole thing, you know, being the, like, working to whatever that was, like being in violence and being in all those things that was keeping me away from who I really am. And it wasn't until I started doing those hard, deep dives that I was like, oh, you just need to shut up and deal with your shit and all the information will come, man. And that's the resonance that I see with you and with, you know, with everybody from your group, is like, it's deeply connected to intuition. It's come from a place that it's not even what's right. It's like connected with what is. Right? I mean, I don't know how else to put it. And that's what the workshop that we did is that.
No, but that's so great, because so many thoughts come to mind, because I had a lot of time to study religion, and I used to wonder, you know, why didn't Christ just kill the devil? Because he had the power, but he had the power to kill all of them. All this, the ones that betrayed him, the ones that stole him, the ones that did, he had the power to do that. And so that was a question that I had a long time. Why didn't he just kill him, right? And so I studied also the Holy Quran, mm-hmm. right? And so the prophet was asked, said, do you have a devil? And he said, of course I have a devil. He said, but I have gained mastery over my devil, and now my devil works for me. And I've commanded him to be in a place. I put him in a place where I command him because he don't have power over me. The thought to rob, or the mindset to sell drugs or to manipulate and all that, it only have the force and power that I give it. And then when I command it to do something, it cannot not do what I say do.
Yeah.
So I tell my devils, plural, get behind me. First of all, back up, because I was following you. So I want you to back up. I want you to go back to a place where you came from. And I demand you to stay there and don't speak unless you are a messenger and a warner to me. Mm. So if something is going to happen that you see, you speak.
Yeah.
From within me, and you tell me that. But other than that, don't give me no suggestions. Don't give me no open-end questions, and don't give me no brilliant ideas.
That's a great point, because so one of my teachers was teaching me this lesson, is that, you know, the perpetrator in me gives me direction, and the victim in me gives me creativity. So it's that, the balance between the two and the integration of the two is where, you know, harmony is. Like, because if you have too much perpetrator, you get yourself in trouble. If you have too much victim, you get yourself in trouble as well. So it's like honoring the yin and the yang, and in the integration of the two, is just such a powerful place. Because I'm one of the most curious things is, like, the more I'm doing this work and the deeper I go, is like the more I can put myself in the position of a perpetrator and understand it, right? And the more I can put myself in the position of a victim and understand it and say, this is, we're the same. Without judgment, without me being entangled with whatever it is, we're the same. It's the same place. It's just, I'm not participating in that one of those sides, right? So it's like this, you can start looking at, and you like get to a place where you can start looking at it and be like, oh, that's interesting. You know, it's like, this is pretty incendiary, you know, it's like incendiary. It's like to have this conversation, but it's like, I was thinking, you know, the tragedy in Parkland, right? It was just this catastrophic scenario. And it's like, in some place we should be running towards that kid, you know, that shooter, and figure out why it happened. It's like, and you know, some people are like, exclude him, this monster, you know, doing that stuff with all this rage and I mean, in some capacity, understandable, you know, not supported, but understandable, you know, like somebody's child was taken away from them. It's the most catastrophic and most horrific thing. One of the most horrific things that can happen to you. But it was taken away by this hurt kid that was a victim himself, right? And so the victim creates the perpetratorship, and then the perpetratorship creates the victimship, and then it goes in this thing, and it creates, and it expands, and until it's like, how can we integrate both things? You know, it's like, and I'm really interested, and because maybe I've been a perpetrator in my life, right? I've been a bully, and I got in fights, and I, you know, it's like I was a kid on the wrong, hanging out with the wrong crowd, you know. But I've also been a victim, you know. It's like, and it, the more I identified as a victim, the more I could justify my perpetratorship. And until I became aware and comfortable with my capacity to be a perpetrator, I wasn't able to release that, you know.
Man, so I grew up seeing people get shot. I've seen a person or a few people get shot to death. So when we hear gunshots, we either duck or we run to it. So-and-so got shot, we run over there. Oh, so-and-so. And then, you know, so I grew up around that. So hearing gunshots and somebody got shot, you know, especially if it's not somebody in the immediate family, you know, it's, you know, it happens, man. I'm used to that, right? And so when I used to see the people in Parkland suffering the way they did, and this is after Hunger Nine. So I'm the one that met the two sisters, Shelly and Samantha. They connected with me in Hunger Nine.
Okay.
And it was because they spirit, we connected so strongly. We connected as beyond brothers and sisters. And we kept that relationship going and expand because they didn't feel what was going on in our community. And I'm telling you, I used to see that stuff on TV, and it was like I would look at it like it was a commercial. Even though the people in Parkland was grieving, even though I had done Hunger Nine, even though I got momentum behind me, even though I don't think wrong. And so Samantha called me, said, I would like for you to speak at our march.
Wow.
So myself went and probably about nine other Circle Brotherhood, along with Susan Nanton, that got Bullets for Life. And so I think I probably was like the fourth speaker. And man, when them people was going up there, that lady who her husband got killed, he had been in the armed forces and he had got killed, and her son, she was talking, and the more the speakers got up and they was talking about the pain, they was talking, and it was just like I had just became aware of their suffering. Because their suffering was different from mine. Because I was used to that. I mean, that wasn't nothing new to me. But I did not come to the realization of the tragedy that happened until I went there into the spirit of the people that were suffering from it.
Yeah.
And I almost couldn't stand. I almost literally almost had to lay down.
Because you're connecting to a new system.
And it was already already there, but I needed to be here with you at your home right now to talk about what we talking about. That what we did at the school was something, but what we doing now, I needed to be here welcoming to your home.
Yeah.
For us to get out what we're getting out right now.
Yeah.
Maybe it wouldn't have never have happened before.
Yeah.
And so because they invited me in that space, I was able to, like you say, make it the yin and the yang is the same. As a matter of fact, it's worse because it was a school massacre. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, oh, and so that was a meditation for me.
Mm.
And then I became more grateful. It made me more grateful that my life, you know, a young boy from time I can remember, my mother, my uncles, her friends, they sold drugs and used drugs from the time I can remember. And so I didn't even thought that I would be living at a certain age. But now I'm living in a day that people that suffer massively called little old brown skin me to take part in a space, in a sacred space, in a sacred place. I'm still like, I have to pitch myself, man, where are you, man?
Mm.
You know, because I didn't put myself in this position, John. I didn't put myself in a position to meet you. It wasn't me. It was the momentum.
No, something else.
And the longing of our ancestors to have their voices heard in this time. And so that's what y'all brought to school is. Everybody that was there, they love it so much because they seem like they know that all their life, and that was probably their first time hearing something like that.
Wow. So how did you get, can you tell me a little bit about how, where did the Hungry Nine come from? Where did that movement start?
So one day we was going, Miss Tangela Sears and Letha and the Moms Against Murdered Children. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, that's, is it MAMA? Is it Mothers Against Murders, Murderers Association or something?
It's Letha and Tangela Sears and that group.
Are they out of West Palm Beach?
No, they're out of, they down south.
Okay.
You know, and so they had a candlelight vigil at the Belafonte Tecosi Center. And so a few of us say, let's go to the candlelight vigil. So we marched in the streets from Mount Calvary Church. We marched down the street chanting, let our children live. Stop killing our children. No justice, no peace. So we probably walked like a quarter of a mile and we ended up at the park, at the Belafonte Tecosi Center Park. And so they had hand paintings of all the children that had got murdered from gun violence. They had the paintings of them, probably like 50 or 75 paintings of children that had got murdered from senseless gun violence. And so, you know, the Circle of Brotherhood, we, you know, wherever we at, we just go into action, you know. And so I walked up, and so I ended up holding a candle. So each mother, when they called their child name, the mother came up and they got a candle. So I was the one that given each of the mothers the candles. And like, oh my God. I mean, I think I probably felt the same thing I felt in Parkland. I was so crushed and so hurt and I felt so helpless, you know. And so as the mothers came up, I gave them the candle. And the brother, the father of King Carter, you know, he was rambling on. He was like, I put my money and when these children need help, they call me and I sell my shirts and I go in my pocket and y'all out here talking, y'all not giving us no funding. And he mad at the pastors and he mad at the people that come out. Y'all come out for the press, but y'all don't do nothing for us. Y'all don't help us do nothing. I'm tired of this shit. And he was just going. His energy, his momentum, it was right. It was good. It was loud to contrast that of the mothers. And so maybe about three or four of us, we were walking back the little quarter mile to our car. Our lead organizer, Brother Leroy Jones, he say, man, we got to do something. He say, we done marched. We done put the picture on the T-shirts. We done did makeshift memorials. We done pulled out liquor. He say, man, we got to do something about this. And so he looked, like, looking into his mind's eye. And he said, I got it. We going to do a hunger strike. So, you know, we just looking at him because he's a brilliant organizer. And the way he said it, he was serious. And so maybe myself and George Jackson and MacArthur Richards, we was the one at the candlelight vigil. We was the one felt what we felt. And so that put in motion the Hunger Nine.
Wow.
So oft times we call Tangela Sears and Santana Carter. Oftentimes we call them the mothers and the fathers of the Hunger Nine.
Mm.
Because that's where that thought originated from. It was because of the pain that we felt and we felt hopeless and we like, what is it can we do that haven't been done before?
I mean, I didn't know anything about, you know, the gun violence that was happening in Liberty City. Yeah. And it brought my attention. You know, I'm not from Miami. So
yeah.
We moved down here in 2012 with my wife and I saw that. I was like, these guys really have something here, you know? And I was like, you know, brought so much attention to it. And I remember, like, I'm a really persistent dude. And I would be like, I'd send an email, and then I'd call, and then I'd get to the wrong place. And then I drove down there a couple of times. And I'm like, I don't know. Hey, who do I talk to? And then, like, this guy just kind of wandering around the school and is like, man, let me see if I can talk to somebody. And I got to you. And I was like, hey, would you be interested in this? And you're like, yeah. And then you got Mark Wolin's book, It Didn't Start With You, about inherited trauma and family systems, right?
Yes.
And then had that conversation, and then, you know, did the podcast with Brother Lyle, and then you guys invited us down. And it's like everything that happens in this world, just the momentum starts with like one little pebble. You know, you see those avalanches, right? It's like one little pebble falls onto another one and then falls onto another one. And then suddenly there's this huge momentum and systemic change throughout the, like, everything, right? And one of the things that, you know, you were saying, like, going into Parkland is like how you could feel you connected with that system, right? It's like if people are together for long enough, they join systems, right? There's this system that if people live together for long enough, and everything creates a new system, new systems, and in that new system, information is exchanged. And it creates a new thing, right? A new thing is born out of it, right? It's like a coral reef, right? There's like fish that are sardines that are going around, but they all live in this larger ecosystem. And that's like my goal for, you know, doing the workshops, is that if we can train more people to do those and provide those resources, little by little, we get a little bit more momentum, and every day, a little bit more momentum of healing. And then what does that look like times 10? What does it look like times 100? What does it look like times 1,000? And every person in their family system is connected to 6, 10 other people, that the more you're healed, the more you're integrated, the more effect you have around in your system. And then it creates that snowball effect.
I tell you, man, it's just that whatever we do, we have to love it, because this system, the system of this world, we do things, those of us that has the momentum to make a great ripple effect in this world. There are some people that say, you know what? Let's keep them poor. As long as we keep them poor, you know, one can sit across from the table from the other and maybe even have a meeting with 40. But I'm going to work him 8 or 10 hours a day on a job. And the energy that he have left, because he still have a family, he got children, he still have to have energy. And we're going to wait and see, and we're going to wait them out, but we're going to keep them poor, so that they can't, or in their mind, that we're not going to make the greatest ripple that's unimaginable, and we are doing it, but they keep us poor.
Can I provide an alternative?
Yes.
So, you know, through that persistence that I have, right, it's like, I'm like poking over here and I'm poking over there, and every no shows me the strength of the system, because in every system has change agents, but also people that keep it the same. And you have to be, for me, it's like, I'm grateful to the people that keep it the same, because if not, it would devolve into chaos, right? But in a lot of those systems, people suffer, right? But there's also the people that change. And the bigger the no, the bigger the system that I'm dealing with. So I try to be really grateful to the no's, and I say, thank you for showing me the strength of the system. Thank you for showing me how much the system is ingrained in this, and I can take that information and use it in my favor, right? And so, like, every time I go down this road and I'm like, I've been, in all reality, I've been trying to talk to you guys for 4 years. So it's like, I'm like, okay, I'm dealing with a big system here. I know that this is going to have this. And it has to go with time and patience and diplomacy. And I can't be like, oh, I'm going to get in here and we're going to do all these things. I'm going to be like, turn your ass around and walk yourself back to Broward County. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's going to be, I can't go into this thing like that. It's just like, it's about building trust and that little pebble that's going to hit another pebble. It's going to hit another pebble. It's going to hit another one. And then we can, before you know it, we have momentum. Like we were talking about yesterday, that the ship can be 2 degrees to the left. And 5 years from now, it's in Antarctica, and it was on its way to China. You know what I mean?
No, and that's the spirit that we have. So I feel exactly the same way, and I'll go as far as to say that so many people, I guess, probably call Brother Lyle's phone all day, every day.
Of course, right? I would imagine.
So many people that he don't have the capacity. It's just him, you know.
And that's part of the system staying the same as well.
And so when I met you, it was just right, man. It wasn't, yeah. I didn't, oh, where you stay, where you live, where you from Broward, I didn't have to get a resume. You know, we didn't have lengthy talks. I see you would text me a lot and hit the like on the Facebook, and I've been seeing you, you know. But the timing was right,
yeah.
And it is right. And I know people that work hard, you know, and most people, they really don't see themselves properly.
Mm.
You know, sometimes it takes somebody to say, hey, John, bro, you got an awesome podcast, man. You have an awesome life, man. Your family is, oh, my God, look like, you know, and then you have to sit back and because you work so hard, you know. You never have a chance to sit back and look at your own self properly.
I suffer from that. Yeah,
you know, because John, we are the ripple in this world, brother.
Yeah.
Whether it come to our reality or whether we sit down and look at ourselves properly, it still doesn't change the fact that that's the way it is.
Yeah,
and so while I talk about the system and how they keep us poor, and we're not poor because people are having conversations about us,
yeah,
about the work that we are doing,
yeah,
in places that we know not. That people know you,
yeah,
they know what you're doing. They always know,
yeah,
you know. So, and that's my driving force.
So, this is gonna be, I can talk about this now. So, my mom works for the U.S. government. She recently retired. Like, I'm talking about 30 days ago, retired. And Sophie, that was at the workshop that we did. So, my mom's a U.S. diplomat, right? She just retired as a U.S. diplomat. And this is, like, ingrained, old, structural things, right? And they had this traumatic event. They were going to this leadership course. And they had this traumatic event happen. There was one of the officers that was one of the Foreign Service officers was married to one of the ladies that was in her class, right? These are guys that are equivalent to like 4-star generals in the military, right? Was in a murder-suicide, right? So they were going through a divorce and the husband shot the wife and then pulled a gun on himself. Just left 2 kids, tragedy, right? And so this senior leadership team wasn't able to talk about this, right? They were going through this course and everybody knew her. And, you know, this tragedy, senseless tragedy had just happened, right? And we were talking about this. My mom and I were talking about this. And like, you should do a workshop. See if you can pull some stuff out, right? Provide some tools for healing. And so today, the U.S. government has paid for a systemic healing workshop. So it's like the tectonic plates of this behemoth of a world opened up enough with the right timing and the right persistence and the right thing for that little thing to go in, close up, and today I can say that that's happened. So we're in a place that's different than yesterday, and that was different than 10 years ago, and then different than 20 years ago. And it seems like it's the human condition for us to continually evolve and get better. And because you have all the intuition and all the knowledge of your parents and their parents and their parents' parents and their all the way back to source. And it was, you know, 400 years ago, it was horrific for you and it's horrific for me. And 1,000 years ago, it was horrific for everybody. And 2,000 years ago, it was really bad. But we get constantly getting better. And that's, I think we're coming to the realization now that there's a system to that, and there's a math to that, and there's a physics to it, and there's a repeatable, measurable token to it. And there's a you can say, okay, what happens if we create movement of systemic healing in a community? What will that community look like in 40, 50 years? What if we give people tools to be able to integrate the pain and heal it and uncover it and then look at it from a safe place and connect with their ancestors and connect with everything that they're doing? What will that community look like in 40 years from now? There's going to be more people that are integrated and connected to source, connected to their who they are.
I'm not surprised, but that is awesome, because you would be surprised who want to have conversations with us. They know they need us. Because, you know, some people, and I, you know, the reason why I don't have problem with people and whatever they do is because I think a person should have the right to be a do whatever they want to do. And just know that there's consequences to whatever you do. So I can't be mad because y'all people were so far up here and really, you know, really probably going a little crazy up there, because everything got to be structured. Everything is on point. And you've been living that life for like 40 something years and you never had a chance for something else, like you say, to come through that's needed. And you know, you needed it.
Yeah.
And that's why we keep working.
Yeah.
Because it's all about when that vibration get to where it's supposed to be, it breaks barriers.
It breaks barriers. It shifts the structure. It's a fundamental shift in the structure. Like and I saw it that night. You know, we've been doing those workshops for 13. I've been involved with that type of work for 13 years, and every single time without fail, it's the same thing, man. It's fundamental, profound healing, and you saw it on the guys that were sitting in that circle and giving the light back and giving the burden back and doing the thing, and the guys crying and guys going through this, like, connecting. And it's like, I've never felt anything like that in my life, man. Like, that isn't all of us. That isn't you. That's underneath all the bullshit and all the trauma and all the pain and all the hurt and all the worry and all the anxiety and all the loneliness. It's all there, right there at your core, man, because we're all coming from the same source. We come from the same place. We all come from that.
And you know, there are some people, like, it's people who lives we touch that we never see or we never hear from. But I heard somebody say something one day. So, and I'm just so, you know, just so happy that me and my own self. It's like when you're into something, and we talked about how things draw unto you, like into your own self. So when I was selling drugs, I can look at a person and tell you, oh, he's a drug dealer. You know, people that love Christ, they can walk into a office, a restaurant, and say, hey, sister. And they know what that means. That means something. It's a connection. You never saw, hey, sister, and you know what that means.
Yeah.
And so when you in a certain type of world, you would draw unto people. That is likened to the mission, and it increased. So I understand, man.
Yeah, and there's you know, like attracts like. You know, the birds of a feather flock together.
Yeah.
Like there's so many, you know, these how I like to look at religion is like, it's been around for a long time for a reason. There's ancient truth in this information. Like the story of Cain and Abel is a story of the first victim and the first perpetrator. And the reason why God curses Cain's family for seven generations is because trauma lasts for seven generations. You know what I mean? So if you look at things as that is like a math equation, you're like, oh, okay. So if my grandfather or my great-grandfather was murdered, somebody in my family might have murdered somebody. And then that violence goes on to the next generation. And then that violence goes on to the next generation. It might skip a generation, and then it looks like something else. But it's the same taking away from. Like, okay, this is a pattern here that's in my family. And it might be an ancient pattern from, you know, thousands of years ago. But it might be a pattern that's from right here. And that compounds and has a capacity of compounding. And, you know, the work is that, in that systemic work is like, we take on things out of loyalty to our family. You say, I love you so much that I'm going to carry this burden. And I'm going to show you that out of loyalty and love and belonging to my family, that I'm going to be an addict or divorced or abandonment or abuse or whatever that looks like. And even success. Success can look like that. That's why it's like, oh, no, my mom's a lawyer, so I'm a lawyer. My dad's an architect, so I'm an architect. My dad's a fisherman, so I'm a fisherman. My mom was a healer, so I'm a healer. They have that. And so do you know where this work comes from? So there was this German psychologist that went to the Zulu tribe in Africa. And he saw that in the Zulu culture, it was a system. And so if somebody murdered somebody in the Zulu tribe, the murderer had to live with the family of the victim and fill that hole. And, you know, it's like this is ancient tribal knowledge. This is knowledge that's been around for so long. And so one of the rites of passages in the Zulu tribe, it's like a bar mitzvah, right? Like a rite of passage. When somebody becomes like from a boy to a man, you would have to say 7 generations back what your family did. So you would say, my father was a hunter and my mother was a healer and my great-grandmother was a medicine woman, and then my great grandfather was a chief, you know, and like my great great grandmother was this, and then the person would also have to say big events that happened. So if you do this, you know, if you're embedded with the Zulu tribe and you're doing these ceremonies, and you're like, oh no, that's normal, like that's the normal cultural thing for the thing, but as an outsider, you're like, oh, there's these patterns that happen, and that. A family has a history and a knowledge and an inherited encyclopedia of information that repeats itself over and over again. It might jump one generation, it might not jump in a generation. So that's why I'm so interested in this stuff. It's like if there's a mechanics to this, you can manipulate it. And manipulate it for healing and for no longer, and for integration and source and connecting to source. And I'm like, through my own journey, I found that the more I deal with my bullshit, the better father I am. The more I deal with my bullshit, the more better husband I am. The more I deal with my bullshit, the better coworker I am, the better boss I am, the better, you know, friend I am, the more I can connect with people and the more I can understand and I can put myself in the position. And until my house is in order, I can't say anything to anybody else. But I can do this podcast and I can have these meaningful, profound conversations and be in a place where I can truly connect with somebody and provide a tool, just a little glimpse into a tool. It might not be for everybody, but hey, I got this little thing, man, and I got to share it.
When a person start doing those things that you describe, start looking at their self and straightening their self out, it opens up a lot of other things. You know, they say if I'm having a problem in my relationship, how can I talk to you and you on your fifth wife? You know what I mean? How can I tell somebody about the oral traditions and have all this knowledge about it and can break it down and I don't live it? So it's like a lot of people, they go in the community. And they used to tell us we was like so zealous in the circle of brotherhood and so zealous to get out there in the community all day when you can on the weekends. And then they start talking about what's going on in your household. Mm-hmm. So you spend all your time saving people in the streets. And then you go home and make a hell in your household. You can't be a healer and your house is sick. It's oxymoronic. But when you get those things together, and it don't seem big, especially to people that don't do it, you know. But when you get yourself together, oh, I'm going out in the morning. So every morning that I get up, I plant my feet on the ground and I thank God. I say, thank you, God, for waking me up this morning. Thank you so much. I mean, with reverence, you know, and compassion. And then I thank my ancestors. Thank you, my ancestors, for doing the things that you're doing, for opening doors and clearing the ways and, you know, and for going through all that you went through, that I could have good blood to flow through my body, even though I got sickle cell traits, but it was worse back then. But you start working those things out. And then I freshen up and all that stuff. Then I anoint myself with oil every morning. And then before I leave, I anoint my wife. And then I tell myself, okay, now you are going out into a world that could be hell. You leaving heaven, you know, because if your home is not your heaven, that means you're going out in hell and then you're coming back in hell. So you have to make your home your heaven. And then you have to get your mind right for what you might encounter out in the world. Mm. And so it's one thing for a person to say who you are in the world, but I need, what about what your wife say about you? What your children say about you at home? You know, how do your dog feel around you? This Mr. Healer, you know.
How do you talk to yourself?
I mean, I just think about things, man. Don't, I try to think about what I'm going to say before I say it.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and I think about my actions. What are my actions going to cause other people? You know, how can I keep peace? How can I keep peace in my home? Okay, well, you did something that I probably wouldn't agree with, but then I have to understand we're different people. You are a female, I'm a male. My name is Albert, your name is Corinthia. You're going to do things different, you're going to think things different, and some things we're going to come together, we're going to agree on together. But I understand that you're a person, and at the end of the day, and early in the morning, I know that you love me. So I could love you enough to give you that freedom too. You know what I mean? And once you good in your home, I promise you that other stuff in the streets is you know, it's just so easy.
Yeah.
And so I would, you know, sit down and talk to myself. And if I, you know, they said, it says that the Christ came to give you a new mind.
Mm.
So if I could get you to not think about a thing, you're not going to react, or you're not going to do that action. Because whatever you do, the thought comes first and it comes fast. But if I could take away the thought of them people that you used to be, the violent person that you used to be, the drug dealer that you used to be, the disrespectful person that I used to be, if I could take those out of your thought process.
Yeah. Yeah, do not be conformed to the patterns of this world.
Then you could work. You could work for God.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the, like, you know, the more I look at different things, is the more I find things that are the same. You know, there's this Japanese guy that has his book called The Book of the Five Rings. It's about mastery of certain things. And he said, when you know the way broadly, you see it in all things, and that's. It's so true. It's like I couldn't see myself because of my own, you know, baloney and my own garbage and my own crap. And it wasn't until I did the hard work and I did the crying and I did the thing and I looked at the shit and I looked at the garbage and I looked at all the crap and I really did, like, really did the soul searching. And it sounds like you did that process with, you know, writing your book of just self-reflection, you know. I wasn't able to see anything else. I couldn't see 2 feet in front of me because of the garbage that I was carrying around.
Yeah.
And I was carrying that garbage out of loyalty to my family.
Yeah.
That, which is a really interesting thing, because that at the end of my day was my ego and saying, I'm going to carry this burden for you. It's like, who am I to carry this burden for anybody? I can't even carry my own crap. So I'm sorry here. I'm sorry for taking this back. And that's what those workshops are. You know, yeah. It's like, I'm, and you do that in a workshop say, here's the burden back. I'm sorry. Thank you for giving me life. That's it. If I can part from that place, I can start with a place of gratitude. Just thank you for giving me life. Whatever the relationship was with my parents, even if they were a sperm donor, even if I was one from rape, whatever that looks like, I can just say, if it wasn't for you and it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. That's it.
That's the vibration. And you know another stronghold that we broke? Man, once they separate us for so many years from white and black, and they done lost that battle. They ran that battle till there wasn't no more juice in it.
Yeah. Yeah. for me, that gets really interesting because I'm very interested in the dynamic of the victim perpetrator, right? And I know we were eventually going to get to this place. And there's something that was really interesting. So Hitler during World War II. So World War I, there was this mass victimization of the German people, right? And so, the Treaty of Versailles, they say, you guys are terrible. Being German is the worst. And they kind of blamed everything on them. But what happened is Germany had this general sense of victimization. And what Hitler comes and does is takes that victimization, distills it into this power, and then uses that power to create perpetratorship, right? And, Carl Jung, famous psychologist, said that Hitler was the voice of the collective subconscious of 78 million Germans, right? Then you find this scapegoat, and the scapegoat could have been aliens, or it could have been, everybody that's tall, over 6'5", it could have been anything, right? And so you find this scapegoat, and you attack that scapegoat, and then you do that. And that story repeats itself in history, and has repeated itself forever, right? It's like a biblical story. It's always this perpetratorship that happens and creates this dynamic. But the thing that always comes up is what happens with unresolved trauma? If you let the unresolved trauma fester long enough, you, through your righteous indignation and using the jurisdiction of God to justify the perpetratorship, and it absolves your responsibility. And I don't mean responsibility in I'm responsible for this. It's ability to respond. Because if I'm frozen then in the trauma and my reactionary force, I can never assume responsibility for me and not absolve my power to the collective. So it's this happens in America with race. You have to understand the catastrophic echoing trauma, generational destruction that happened with industrialized slavery in the United States. And if you can't come to terms with accepting it for what it is, how can you begin to heal it? You're saying it's not my fault. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't my fault. But I'm part of the system. And I accept my ability to respond to this collective. Because I'm part of the collective conscious of whatever this thing is. I'm part of it. And I'm going to do whatever comes across, whatever calls me to do that thing, to be able to give tools to be able to address that.
That's why I thank God for young people. Mm. Because a lot of young people, they don't go, oh, that's my friend. What? That's my friend. You know, a lot of people, and John, I tell you, we teach a thing called the Willie Lynch letter. And the Willie Lynch letter is describe what you was talking about. Let's put the old against the young. Let's put the tall against the short. Let's put the coarse hair against the kinky hair. Let's put the male against the female. Always have to have somebody being a victim, but you always have to try to find a right justification to do the things that you do. I did it because my parents did it. I did it because this. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, why do you do it? I don't know, because my parents did it. You can't even justify And young people, they start bringing that to light. So, no, man, it's just a wonderful feeling, man. When y'all came down to our school, and they didn't know what color y'all was, John. It wasn't even a thought. I mean, things were just so right and powerful, man.
And that's, you know, I think that the only place that I can come from source, right, that I'm truly connected is from that place. Yeah. And when you're saying we're recognizing there's a resonance here that there's like, this is another human being and I'm another human being. That's it, man.
Yeah.
Whatever all their shit and all their bullshit and whatever, that has nothing to do with us, man.
Yeah. You know? And even if, and it was, John, it was so powerful because I always speak for me. So I don't go for all that. Oh, he made me slap the shit out of him. No, he didn't make you do anything. Nobody makes you do. Everybody wanted to. Oh, the devil made me do it. Stop. Okay. First of all, where is the devil?
Yeah.
And what did he do to make you do what you did? So anytime that we look for an outside source that we could poke the blame to, no, he did it. He made me do it. If it was, no, what about your responsibility to have consciousness, to be able to think about what you're doing? At some point, you may go along with it and go along with it. At some point, a light will click on. No, it's me that's causing trouble in the home. When I sit back and think about it, it's me that started the argument because I had a bad day, and I didn't let my household understand that sometime when you go through stuff in life, the people that get the pressure is the people that's close to you.
Yeah.
So I could look at my wife when she come home and kind of tell, should I play with her? Should I not play with her? What kind of tone should I say? Talk to her. Do I need to just leave her alone, give her some space, let her wind down? I could look at her. I could hear her voice on the phone and know what type of response to give her. Because I understand, oh, no, she loved me. She's having a bad day. Let me just. And just because a person don't understand that, you know what I mean? It's always me.
Yeah.
It wasn't my mom.
It was me.
It wasn't my dad. I made a conscious choice. Was there pieces around that probably could have contributed? Yes. But at the end of the day, I blame it on me because if I blame it on somebody, then I'm going to have to look for somebody to fix it.
Yeah.
And what if they don't want to fix it? Then I'll just stay broken. I'll just stay the perpetrator. I'll just know.
Yeah.
So I'll say this, John. I remember when my daughter passed in prison. I couldn't go to the funeral, and I did not want to come to the realization that she had passed. Mm. So I told my wife, "Don't send me no pictures. Don't send me no funeral videos." And then me and her, we was at odds because she was living in a reality that I couldn't comprehend. So a whole year went by and sometime my daughter would come visit me by herself on a Friday. But on Fridays, I go to religious service around the same time. So when people thought that I was getting dressed to go to religious service, I was getting dressed hoping that my daughter come see me. And this went on a whole year. And so rage started building up in me. Resentment started building up in me. Me and my family is at odds, right? But guess what? I'm a minister. I help people when people die. I help console people when they have bad relationships. They come to me for that. And I was still doing that. While at the same time, rage was building up at me, right? And just to make a long story short, one guy did a simple thing. And at that point, I just figured, man, I got to kill him for what he did. Now, I'm going to wait in the back till he come back here. I'm going to kill him because he disrespect me. And so I was sitting in that back waiting on this human being to come in the back for me to kill him. I mean, for real, John. And so I'm sitting back there, right? And I said, man, you in trouble. I start having a conversation with myself. No, you in trouble. So I asked the pastor, "Pastor, I need to speak to you. Not right now. We got to clean this place up." So I go back in the back. If he come back here, I'm going to stab him. And so I'm sitting down. I'm crying. I'm like, "Man, you in trouble. Something wrong with you." I say, "What's wrong with you?" And some say, "I don't know." And some say, "You know what happened, going to happen to you if you kill that man?" I said, "Yeah, I know what's going to happen." "So you going to do it?" "Yeah." And so now I'm crying profusely, I'm uncontrollably, and then at some point, I get a chance to talk to the pastor, and he prayed for me, and he lay hands on me, and that was good, but it wasn't enough. And so I walked right out of his door, and some say, "Go in the psychiatry department." It was after I knocked on the door. "We're closed. If it's an emergency, you can't see us." I said, "It's an emergency." And I went in there. And that psychiatrist, she started telling me everything that was wrong with me. And I was grieving and never gave it an outlet. And then it turned into rage, and then it turned into violence. And I went through that one whole year. Build up. And as I was getting that new information, I knew scripture. I knew how to pray. I knew about the Quran. I knew about these things.
Yeah.
But nothing that I could pull up in my mind about Christ, it didn't come up powerful enough for me to change what I was going through. And once that lady told me the process of grieving, if you don't deal with grieving properly, it turns into a ticking time bomb. And that's the same thing that you just explained.
Yeah.
When you don't deal with that stuff.
Yeah.
So now I understand it now. I was a preacher.
Yeah.
And I did not understand the process of releasing grief.
And for me, that it's the way to understand that. So when you were saying that, it's like, one of the big things that the things that I've wrestled with the most is like, what is it really to assume responsibility? What is it really to assume responsibility? It's like, I assume responsibility for all the perpetrators that came before me. And I assume responsibility for all the victims that came before me. And that I have the capacity to be a monster, and I have the capacity to be an angel. Sitting with that, with the capacity of that, is humbling, terrifying, and catastrophic all in the same feeling, right? It's like, unless I have the capacity to be all those things, and everybody around me has the capacity to be all those things, so who am I to judge them?
But it's the work that we do. Because the same way that I could have felt about my parents, my brother would tell you, he would say, "My brother Albert, he is like my daddy."
Mm.
I followed him. If he told me to kill somebody, I would kill somebody. So my brother done 20 years in prison because I was his leader, John. And I couldn't serve my time because I was worried about him. You hear me? And every day I look at him, I say, "Man, I wasn't a good brother." And that's why I try every day. If I'm going to lead somebody, I'm going to be right. And I told my lawyer, I said, "Tell the federal government, if they would let my brother go, I would sign for a life sentence and never get out of prison again."
Mm.
And it's because of the work that we do. And I promise God, I say, "God, if you let me out of this prison, I'll do everything that I could imagine to go back into my community and make it a better place." I didn't do it myself. I helped. But I do all that I can every day to be a better leader and a better person. And the only thing that keep me going, because I get some things I think about I'm weeping right now because I thank God for giving me another chance that people could follow me the right way now, John. I don't have to do it like my mom and them did it. I don't have to do it like my children and my brother children, none of them have went to prison.
Mm.
None of them sell drugs.
They did it differently.
None of them is in the system. So we did, between me and my brother, we did 42 years in prison. We did that thing for them. So it breaks generational curses with that, with junkies and robbers and murderers and cutthroats and no good. Even if the history did have an algorithm to it.
Yeah.
Bum, 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 bum. We shifted through the cracks.
Yeah. And that's where you know it's working. Because the proof is in the pudding, right? It's the lack of chaos. It's the lack of noise. The line becomes clearer, becomes more concentrated. It's a little bit differently.
And we were sent here to do this.
Yeah.
We was already kings. We'd done that before. So now we're doing this. And that's what keeps the beast at bay.
Mm.
Where you can control it.
Yeah.
You stop doing good and stop doing the work, the beast revs up. He gets strong because you feed him.
Yeah.
And I feed him. Now, when we see a beast, we see him from like 2 miles away and come to beast. And we know how to deal with him.
Yeah.
And he knows. That's why that thing told Christ, why you come to throw me out before my time? Why you come? It ain't my time yet. You don't know when your time is. I'm the one to tell you when your time is.
Yeah.
You don't even have enough control to tell me when your time is, beast. And it's right in us. It's still right there. So he never killed the devil because the devil still had a purpose. You take the devil away, then what you got? What is the contrast? And so it's people like you and I in the world that's going to be here, and we was always here, and we'll always be here.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to end it. I couldn't have said it better, man. Brother Albert, how do we get a hold of you? How do you tell me about your Facebook, your Instagram, how do you get a hold of people like if they want to get involved with the Brotherhood, if they want to support, if they want to talk to you, if they want to support your podcast? How does that work?
So I have a new podcast that I'm just starting it, and you could subscribe at Albert Sonny Campbell. It's very new. I don't even have enough followers to go mobile yet, so it's very new. It's very raw, you know. And I'm always available. Like, I'm an open book. Like, I'm just, like, my phone number is 786-858-2283.
Listen, man, if you keep doing the videos in your car, driving home, like, those are super. I always listen to those, man. Like, you know, they have words of wisdom, you know. It's just about putting yourself out there and putting the content out there, man. You're connected. So, you know, keep doing what you're doing, man. It was awesome having you on the podcast, man. I really appreciate this. This is, the momentum is continuing.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm connected to you, my brother.
All right. Thanks, man.
You're welcome.